Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Aerospace and Defense Forum, our joint meeting between the Orange County and Santa Clarita Valley chapters for today, March 4th, 2020. Ivan, can you give us the next slide, please? I'm the chapter chair of the Santa Clarita Valley chapter. And for those of you who are not exactly sure where Santa Clarita is, it's about 40 miles north of LAX. Normally, in non-COVID times, we meet at College of the Canyons University Center. And I want to thank the Santa Clarita Valley Economic Development Corporation. They do a tremendous job up here with businesses and are involved in a variety of things, and they are our sponsor. Next slide, please. Also, the Orange County chapter, and Paul is on. He's the chapter chair. You want to go ahead, Paul?
So, what is the default? So,
thanks. I appreciate that. So, Moss Adams has been a great sponsor for us. City National Bank, Golden Chubb. We've got a lot of people that have helped out to grow the chapter. We thank them.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Next slide, please.
Hello, this is Dave.
Hey, Dave. This is
everybody on mute, please.
Good. Good to hear your voice. How you doing, sir?
Good, thanks. You keeping warm wherever you are?
All right. Gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, please go on mute. Thank you. Okay. Aerospace and Defense Forum, 11-year-old Global Aerospace and Defense Leadership Community. We have 8 chapters, 2,400 executives, professionals. You can see that various chapters all over California, plus Arizona, Dallas, Fort Worth. Normally we have monthly meetings with networking, discussion, presentations. In this era, we've been doing virtual meetings and still doing networking. We had a networking meeting last year that went very well around Christmas time. We expect in the future to return to face-to-face meetings with on-site tours now that theoretically, vaccinations will be ready for everybody by the end of May. Hopefully, we can start those up sometime in the summertime. We will do what we need to do to be safe, obviously. And for members, there's access to a variety of related resources, presentations, recordings, and slides. Next slide, please. I want to introduce Jacob Horn. Jacob has a deep background in cybersecurity. And he has presented before for us. He's going to cover a variety of things for cybersecurity. And I don't have access to his bio right now, but it is online. You'll find him a valuable resource. I very much enjoyed talking to him. And there's a lot of information to cover. So I'm going to turn this right over to Jason and allow him, I'm sorry, Jacob, allow him to take the screen.
Alrighty, awesome. Let's get set up here.
And Jacob, if you can give us just a minute on your background.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody, you can see those slides okay here.
Yes.
Yes, awesome. Go ahead.
Perfect. Great, yeah. So I believe on the invite, my bio's on there as well if anybody's curious. But I've been working in cybersecurity for about 15 years now. I started out my career on active duty in the Navy. Where I was an NSA intelligence analyst doing some really cool stuff prior to Cybercom existing. After Cybercom stood up, then things got a little more normal. I did some blue team operations, some cyber defense style operations towards the end of my career in the Navy. And then as I got out as a civilian, I worked as a security operations center analyst and basically have spent most of my career across the arc of cybersecurity in the public sector. Recently, over the last several years, has been working my way through the supply chain from the prime integrator level, doing work for AT&T government or Northrop Grumman, all the way down to working with CMTC and the Manufacturing Extension Partnership. So you could go basically from the super prime level all the way down to the small manufacturing level. And now I run a small consulting practice called DefCert, where we specialize in working with small to medium-sized manufacturers who have DFAR cybersecurity compliance obligations, specifically those folks who are trying to pass CMMC level 3 certifications and need to go through those compliance transformations. So that's the super high 30,000 foot view of my bio. If anybody has questions about it, then feel free to reach out, and I got plenty of stories. So getting down to today, we were saying earlier, there is a ton of information to cover because, as you may have noticed, a lot of CMMC webinars don't really tell you very much information. They basically regurgitate a lot of the same bullet points. It's a lot of the same talking points. A lot of it is just stuff straight out of the model with a lot of cryptic diagrams that don't really inform you about anything. And what we've seen in the field working with manufacturers is basically one major problem. And the biggest problem that manufacturers have is dealing with technical debt related to their compliance posture. And what I mean by that is all of the things that are missing that for some reason feel like they ought to have been there. This could be technical and non-technical requirements, documentation, technologies, vendor service agreements. There's just all these things that are missing. And when people read the CMMC model, or they read NIST 800-171, or they read any of these documents that they need to comply with, they're always very confused about where this is coming from, why it applies to them, what these silly terms even mean, and why it seems like they're way behind the curve in terms of what has been expected in order to pass these certifications. So because we are in between the next major release of the final rule of DFARS that is going to make people be compliant with CMMC and all the various other obligations, we're in a little bit of a valley of webinars where there's not a lot of new things coming out to overwhelm you. So we're going to take a step back, and we're going to take a look at the origins of where this technical debt comes from in order to add some context around why it feels like you're so far behind the curve. And the way that we're going to do that is essentially in two ways. We're going to take a very detailed look at the assumptions that the government has made over the last decade or so about the nature of your business and the nature of your information security programs in those businesses. And then we're going to take a look at the common assumptions that manufacturers make about those compliance standards. And it should become very obvious very quickly that when you combine those two sets of assumptions, it makes for a sticky situation when it comes down to what the current reality is on the ground today. All right. So, everybody knows what they say about assumptions, right? So let's dive in here. So I've spoken at the Aerospace and Defense Forum before. Originally was back on one of the original models, the draft model of CMMC, in December of 2019. And most recently in July of last year. So there's going to be some things that we don't cover in as much detail. If you're curious about some of that content, definitely go back and look at those talks or reach out independently. There's just so many aspects to the whole ecosystem that we can't go into each one every single time. So think of these three talks as being somewhat cumulative. Okay, so just some quick background. The executive order that starts off as sort of the big bang moment that expands all of these compliance obligations to the industrial base started in May of 2009 when President Obama signed this memorandum. And the reason why I bring up the memorandum that happens before the executive order is because it's very important to keep in mind that the memorandum and the executive order and the subsequent rules are addressed to the executive branch agencies. Overwhelmingly, the thing that I see a lot of people misunderstand is that they think that the CUI program is a program that's being written by NARA and ISOO and these other government agencies to you, the manufacturer. That is not true. They are creating a CUI program by the direction of the federal government in order to be implemented for the federal government. We are several steps removed from that process, and that's one of the main reasons why there's going to be some confusion just a few slides from now. So he signs that memorandum, and I've brought this up in a previous talk before. This is a report that you don't hear people talk about very much. So all the executive agencies get together in order to review the CUI program that had existed for years at this point, but not in any sort of way that we would recognize today. And they come up with a list of 40 recommendations for the Obama administration. And the number one recommendation that they make is we need a drastic expansion of the CUI program to be more than just unclassified terrorism information. It needs to be basically all of this unclassified information that the government deals with in all of the federal agencies, because there's just too many things going on. We can't share it. We don't know what's going on. Please expand the CUI program. So an executive order gets signed, and he basically just bottom lines that report, all 40 of those recommendations. So if you're curious about, after we get through this talk, if you want to blame the executive order, don't blame the executive order, blame the report from the agencies themselves who asked for the executive order. All right, so he signs this executive order, and there's basically a three-pronged master plan that needs to be put into place. And remember, this is 11 years ago. So we need three things to happen for this massive data reform to occur on the federal government side. We need a federal CUI program that is for the agencies, to the agencies, in order for them to develop their CUI policies, in order for this thing to actually get kicked off. We have to have a regulation that makes them do it, that implements the executive order. Then, because the government runs off of acquisitions, we have to have a federal acquisition regulation. We have to have a FAR rule that also implements the other side of that process, because that data is going to flow through the supply chain for all of these executive agencies. So we have to have those two things together in order for it to work. Problem is, federal information systems have a humongous catalog of security requirements. They have very formal processes. It's a humongous system that gets implemented in order to protect federal information systems and federal data. I know it doesn't seem like it's working very well based off the headlines in the news recently, but it does exist. So they can't push that down into the supply chain through the FAR rule. They have to create some security requirements for non-federal systems. For those of you familiar with 800-171, that's what we're going to get to. But we need these three things when the executive order gets written, in order for the totality of the CUI program to work. So how do we get from November of 2010 with the executive order from Obama and the three big things that we need to do all the way over until last month, when President Biden signed an executive order that has the supply chain and the executive agencies doing all kinds of stuff and updating reports? What happened between 2010 and 2021? So what actually happened, and this is the part that a lot of people don't go back and read. I was telling folks before the meeting started, I don't know what everybody else has been doing when coronavirus has been going on, but I've been going in and reading the Federal Register. So we're going to rip through all the rule updates. Now, you might be curious to say, well, look, I mean, the rules are, they're updated and they're superseded and they're replaced. So why would you go back and read the old rules? It is true that the rules that were written have been replaced by the current version of the rules in the Federal Register. However, it is very insightful to read the assumptions that the government makes very clear and apparent up front when they wrote the rules at the time, because what occurred is there are, in a vacuum, basically reasonable assumptions made for every update along this timeline. But each time a new rule update comes out, we have a ratcheting effect of assumptions, where they base the new assumptions off the old assumptions, and so on and so forth. And that's really the recipe for the technical debt that we were talking about earlier. So in March of 2010, everybody knows that the executive order is coming. The federal government has to get started. And DOD says, this is going to take a really long time. We have data that we need to protect. And so we're going to try to get the drop. We're going to get the ball rolling, and we'll just integrate our own guidance as these overall big three prongs start to come out. So in March of 2010, they say in the Federal Register, hey, here's just this request for comment. It's an advance notice of public rulemaking. We got to come up with a rule to figure out how we're going to handle this unclassified data. We know the executive order is coming. We know that this is the change on the horizon. So they ask for public comment. And they say, hey, this is going to happen. And they say, we have to implement these adequate security measures in order to protect unclassified information from unauthorized access and disclosure. You may notice that some of the verbiage and the writing style of the Federal Register is incredibly cryptic and not user-friendly at all. So even though there's some large bullets on the screen, we'll just try to rip through them as quickly as possible. When you get a copy of the slides, I recommend that you go back and actually read some of the verbiage. It's very interesting to see how they change descriptions of the same thing throughout the years. So we got to implement adequate security. We have to prescribe reporting to the government. Sounds very familiar, right? This is exactly what everybody is dealing with these days. So in this initial notice to everyone, they say, we're going to do two things. We're going to have a DFARS clause that gives basic protections. We're going to have a DFARS clause that provides enhanced protections. We don't know what the numbers are going to be, but this is kind of what we want to do. And they say there's all these relevant information types that we need to protect that the DoD sends out into the supply chain. So we're going to apply both sides to these different sets of data. Now, you may notice that some of these sets of data sound and look very familiar, and it is the same set of data that started in 2010 that's been carried all the way through today that requires these safeguarding protections. We just start to change how we describe them and how we categorize them as the CUI program slowly starts to develop. But you can go back in time and actually pull apart pre-CUI program what the different data types are that the DoD wants to protect. And as you can see in the middle with these controlled access and dissemination designations, they were like over 150 different markings and dissemination designations within the federal government at the time. So they said, we have to apply basic and enhanced protections to all of them. So really they're showing why the CUI program was inevitable. You just weren't going to be able to put these protections in the supply chain without normalizing what was going on. Okay, so they put out this request for comment, and then a little while later, they actually come out with a proposed rule. So it goes into the Federal Register, and they say, we have to avoid this compromise of unclassified information. We have to prevent the exfiltration of data, and we're going to do that with these two rules. But you notice the first rule was called safeguarding unclassified or just safeguarding DoD information. Here they say it's, well, we're just talking about unclassified information. They have to stumble over themselves as they change the definitions. So we still have the basic clause. We still have the enhanced clause. And they say, oh, well, we're going to need to provide basic protections for all of these different things, all these different capabilities within a business and the supply chain. And when you need enhanced protections, there are 59 controls from NIST Special Publication 853, which we've talked about before on some aerospace and defense forum talks. For those of you that don't know, it is a catalog, a massive catalog of thousands and thousands of different controls that can be applied to federal information systems through a process where they whittle down the ones that are applicable or not. Here they gave a list of 59 of them, and they said, this is what you need whenever we give you this clause that says you have to have enhanced protections. And then they say that adequate security is this cryptic nonsense where you're going to apply these measures, which are really just sort of capability statements, commensurate with risk, that, you know, you kind of get to figure out on your own. It is not prescriptive. It's very nebulous. It's very open-ended. And I wish we were in person so that we could actually laugh about how ridiculous this statement is, because imagine seeing that in your contract when they say, this is adequate security. So this is relevant because if you look in your contracts now and at the current version of DFARS, what they define as adequate security is very specific. So they start to whittle down into very specific guidance as these rules progress. So they say that the basic clause is just basically part of routine business. This isn't that big of a deal. It's stuff that you do every day. It's part of it being a prudent business owner. But that on the enhanced side, there's going to be some data that has special handling and reporting. This is very similar to the eventual CUI program that splits CUI into two different designations. You have basic CUI and you have CUI, or, and then you have CUI specified. So the DoD all the way back in 2011 is saying some of our data has more than just basic protections. And this is actually what ends up turning into covered defense information as a special type of CUI. But we'll get to that part. So this is my favorite part of this proposed rule that came out. They list off their assumptions and they say, we believe it is a reasonable rule of thumb that small business security budgets total 0.5% of your revenue. So your cybersecurity budget in 2011 was 0.5% of your total revenue. That's the baseline assumption that they're operating off of, in addition to the fact that everything they list in this basic clause on the left is something you're already doing. Okay. So a little bit of time goes by. Remember, we have to have three things. We have to have the federal program, we have to have the FAR rule, and we have to have the security standard. So what's going on with the FAR rule? Well, a proposed one comes out in August of 2012, and they say the same thing. They say the safeguarding of covered contractor information systems that possess government data needs to be protected. And how about this for an objective statement? If you have the federal government, the most obscure part of the federal government, write an objective statement. This is what you get. Basically, they said we have to protect data at a very basic level. I won't subject you to reading that that objective statement on screen. You should go back and try to pick it apart. It's pretty difficult. Okay, so what happened was they took that proposed rule that had basic and enhanced protections and they split it in two. They said the basic side is going to go over to the FAR rule. The enhanced side is going to stay a DFARS rule. So this is going to be something that's applicable to all federal acquisitions. This is going to be something that's applicable only to DOD side of federal acquisitions. It's a supplement. So it's basically the same verbiage. They say, hey, we're going to add a clause to the FAR. We don't know what the number is going to be. And it requires the contractor to add in these security measures for these basic categories of things. They don't tell you anything more than that. They just say, for these areas that you have happened during the day, you're going to add security protections. Good luck. And remember, this is just the proposed rule. So they're basically saying, this is the idea, give us your comments, and then we'll get back to you. However, they do stop and say that the cost impact is not supposed to be significant because these first level protection measures are part of what you do in the routine course of doing business. We're going to say this a lot over the years, and you'll notice that it is the exact same thing that the people in charge of CMMC are telling you. Really, the story hasn't changed over the last decade. And then they say that it applies to everybody regardless of size of ownership. This is the other theme that's going to get pulled forward through the years. Doesn't matter what size the business is. Doesn't matter what you do. If you get these clauses in your contracts and you have the data, you have to protect it with the things that you're already doing. Okay. So then in November 2013, the finalized rule comes out from the proposed rule in 2011. So you'll notice that's a pretty big gap, and this is relevant when we get to today because we're waiting on the final rule to come out for CMMC. Now, I don't think we're going to be waiting 2 years, and that has some implications that we'll find interesting because when they publish these final rules, they go through in excruciating detail every comment that was provided to the government on the rule, and they address every single one of them. And the current rule has many, many, many more comments than any of these previous rules did. So if you're reading ahead, if they have 10 times the number of comments, but they're saying that the final rule is going to come out in a few months, then that probably means that they're not going to change the rule very much. So we have the final rule, and they say, hey, we split out just the enhanced requirements. The basic requirements went to the FAR. We reduced the scope of the information that's covered because we're not saying protect all unclassified DoD information. We're saying only protect unclassified controlled technical information. They did us a favor, and they said we narrowed the scope. And they said you don't have to retain the data related to an incident indefinitely. You only have to retain it for 90 days, which is still the requirement today. And when we ask you to report an incident, there's only going to be 13 things that we ask for. It's no big deal. A lot of people at the time now, because this is 2013, 3 years after the executive order, said, what about the CUI program? And they said, listen, when they asked everybody for how many policies the federal government had, they got a list of 2,200 different documents. That is now in the CUI registry is about 20 different documents. So the reason why it took 6 years from the executive order to the final rule with the CUI registry is because they had to synthesize 2,000 different instructions. Meanwhile, the DoD is saying we still have to protect the data that we provide to the industrial base. So we don't have a policy for the agencies. We don't have a policy for industry. And we have existing authorities to protect this information. So this is the rule. Okay. Same thing that we just saw before. The increased costs that are going to come with having enhanced protections because you're already doing basic should be accounted for through the normal course of doing business. They say these are just allowable costs that are going to be spread across multiple contracts that are going to get rolled up into indirect cost pools as part of your overhead G&A. Does that sound familiar? Because that's exactly what the government is telling you about the current costs associated with CMMC. It has been the exact same guidance for essentially a decade. And then one of my favorite parts about this version of the rule is they say, hey, those controls from 853, the ones that are way too burdensome to actually put on contractors in the industrial base, well, they kind of sort of map to an ISO standard, which is an industry standard, not a federal standard. And therefore, we assume that the costs will be reasonable because they're kind of similar. Obviously, that is quite the assumption and quite the logical jump, but this is how they have justified their thinking about it over the years. So then they say again, the contractor size is not a reason to allow a contractor to fail to protect this information, and that the government does not intend to directly pay for the costs associated with the rule. Remember, this is in 2013, not last week when they said it again. They've been saying the same thing. All right. So, like I said, it took 6 years for this formal rule to come out. In my last talk in July, we talked about the 32 CFR rule itself in excruciating detail and how it relates to DFAR 7012 currently in your contract clauses. So if you're curious about what that top line is doing, I'd say go back and watch that recording. So anyways, we have these rules getting developed. And then in June of 2015, OPM gets hacked. It's the largest compromise of federal information at the time, and it compromised all the information for security clearance investigations. It was a terrible embarrassment. It was a horribly detrimental event to have happen, and it basically accelerated China's ability to have their intelligence community know what's going on by decades. It was absolutely horrific. So the White House actually reaches out to NARA when this happens and says, what are you working on? What's going on with the CUI program? What are we going to do about this? And they make NARA send out 800-171, which is the document that most of us are familiar with now. If you actually look at the dates, 800-171 was part of this three-pronged plan, but it gets published way before the other two do. And the reason is because of how bad the OPM hack actually was. So what is in 800-171? This could be its own talk in and of itself, but we're going to walk through it very quickly. Like I said, 853 is a catalog of thousands of different controls that get applied to the federal information system space, and it has to get filtered in various ways. And there's various documents and processes and steps that they have to go through, but 800-171 takes all of those requirements, and they do the filtering for you. They come up with the minimum baseline standard that you have to apply to this unclassified information in non-federal systems. And they take those thousands of controls and they whittle it down to 110 requirements. But how do they do that? They have to make several assumptions. So they assume that non-federal organizations are not going to be developing an environment dedicated to processing CUI, and that when we develop 800-171, it has to be relatively comfortable, Ron Ross says, for the organizations based off of what they're already doing, just like they say with the basic controls. For those of you who don't know Ron Ross, just Google him. He's the mastermind behind a lot of what NIST does. So there's some more assumptions in the document, and they say, hey, the safeguarding measures that are put in place, they already have some, and they may be sufficient, so we're not really asking for a huge delta of controls. And so Ron Ross says, we assume they already have stuff in place, that they're already using an information security program, and that they're protecting their stuff because they have to in order to stay in business. How would you stay in business if you didn't have an information security program? Of course businesses have an information security program, says the federal government in 2015. So at the bottom here, he says, we know that they're already doing a lot, and that was one of the tailoring criteria. We didn't want to tell them things that we assumed that they were already doing. Remember, we've already made one big assumption about what your budget is and what you're doing for basic protections. We're about to make a bunch of assumptions about the controls that are going to get applied. So Ron is even at the point when he's giving this talk in 2015, he says some of these assumptions might be wrong, but we had to make design decisions with regards to how the requirements came out. We had to make the sausage somehow. We had to make some assumptions. So if you go to Appendix E, it's the most interesting part of 800-171. They list off which assumptions they made. There's 62 of them, and these are called NFO controls, which are controls expected to be routinely satisfied without specification. And Ron Ross describes these as, we went through and took a hard look and said, do we really have to tell people to do this, or should this be expected? In the modern world of having security programs, these requirements, we don't think we should tell people to have to do them, these 62 things. So what's in those 62 things? Well, the main thing that is in that body of NFO controls are all of the -1 controls from 853. The very first control for every group of controls are the policies and procedures. And they said this was not something that we wanted to tell people to have to do, because we assume that you already have a risk-based security program with 0.5% of your total revenues being pumped into it that's already doing all of these things. So why would we tell you to write policies and procedures? That would be nonsensical. It would make the standard too large. Yet when you go into a manufacturer today and you start talking to them about their NIST 800-171 compliance, what's the first thing everybody says? We don't have any documentation. We don't have any procedures. And most of the burden that they feel like they're facing in the eyes of CMMC has to do with the documentation. So they already omitted it because they assumed that you were already doing it. And you can start to see, you know, back from 2011 into 2013 into 2015, we're making several very large assumptions about what your security program is supposed to be looking like. My favorite control to bring up for every manufacturer that is under the thumb of this compliance regulation is in Appendix E, and it is SA-9, External Information System Services. For those of you, which is most of you most likely, that use managed services provider, please go read what's inside this control, because this is the one that the government assumed that you were doing the entire time, that said you were going to require the providers of external systems to comply with your security program, and that you were going to be employing techniques and processes to monitor compliance with your security requirements by your external providers on an ongoing basis. So they assumed that you were already managing what was going on because, of course. Now, I want to stop here and sort of bring up a humorous point. You know, Daniel Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in economics by pointing out that people are not rational actors, and that the theory of economics didn't match up with how people really behave. This feels very similar in that the government said, we have this model of what the perfect rational business in the sub-tiers of the supply chain is actually going to be behaving like, and they're going to be doing these things, and therefore we can make these assumptions. So I'll take my Nobel Prize now by letting them know that's not actually how businesses in the industrial base really work. And a lot of these assumptions were completely wrong. So we have one of our three prongs with the security standard for non-federal information systems, but we're still waiting on the FAR rule. We're still waiting on 32 CFR for the federal agency overall CUI program. So in July 2015, the Office of Management and Budget releases their little request for comment that says, hey, this is what we're planning on doing, and this is going to be the eventual FAR rule. So I want to stop right here and let everybody know, if you think that 800-171 and CMMC are going to go away, go read that document, because it's very short. It's about 2 pages, and the main thing that they say is that folks who are doing work in the industrial base are going to comply with 800-171. This becomes relevant later because we're still waiting on this rule to come out. But we are in the industrial base dealing with one subset of one federal agency's implementation of this program. That FAR rule is what drives all the federal agencies to include this in their contract. So the industrial base and manufacturers and all the angst that everyone is feeling with the requirements today, really just the canary in the coal mine versus what eventually is coming. We're going to add some details to that. Okay, so like we said, in June of 2015, OPM gets destroyed. The federal government gets embarrassed, China wins, and it's a terrible, terrible information breach. So suddenly, in August of 2015, we release an interim rule to the DFARS. We haven't done anything since November of 2013 at this point. So you go to the Federal Register, and they say, oh, we got to improve information security, same boilerplate language. And then there's a bunch of paragraphs that say, there's an urgent and compelling reason to promulgate this interim rule. You think it's because the OPM was completely compromised? So they say recent high-profile breaches of federal information show us that we have to improve what's going on, yada, yada, yada. This is important to remember because if you've been paying attention to the news, it feels like we're repeating history. Okay, so then they come out with this interim rule, and they say, we don't even have time to propose a rule. here's an interim rule, and we're going to do two things. We're going to give you a provision, and we're going to give you a clause. The provision tells you, hey, there's requirements that you have to comply with when you accept this contract clause. The clause itself says, hey, here are the safeguarding requirements that you're going to have to put in place by the terms of this contract. So they even say that the scope of the clause is expanded because, remember, in 2013, we narrowed everything down just to controlled technical information. We downscoped everything. And they say, hey, we're going to expand this scope because we have to have a lot of reporting because there's been a humongous breach and we don't know what's going on. So then they say that of the required reporting fields, remember, originally there were only 13, but they include this little line in this interim rule that says of those required reporting fields, several of them are going to require an information technology expert to provide the information describing the incident. That's very different from saying this is no big deal. This is what you're doing already. There's only 13 things. This is only in the rule once, but it's quite the assumption because if you're going to have to employ people every time you report, all the estimates based off of how often you have to report means that that 0.5% of your budget are probably going to get squeezed a little bit. So moving on some more in terms of what they include in the interim rule, they say, hey, we have great news. We published NIST 800-171. You don't have to do those 853 controls anymore. They're federal specific. There's a bunch of extra stuff in there that you don't need to do. They're very nebulous. We hear you. We understand that these don't make any sense. So we created a tailored version. We went through the filtering process. We went through all of these thousands of controls, all the baselines, all the stuff, and we came up with 110 things. You're welcome. We did an analysis, and we determined that it's going to reduce the amount of work that you have to do by 30%. So, yeah, we increase the scope of what you have to do, but it's actually less work. I can hear all the folks who are familiar with 800-171 laughing right now, even though we're not in person. This is why I wish we were in person. Okay, so then August 2015, this massive increase in the scope of the rule comes out. In December of 2015, they release another interim rule, and it's an update to the one that came out in August because a bunch of people provided comments, and they said, hey, that's a lot of stuff that we need to do, and we're not saying that we didn't implement anything, and we're totally not saying that we haven't been doing what you've been asking us to do for the last several years, but it would be really great if you gave us an extension. So when everyone talks about the December 31st, 2017 deadline for implementing 800-171, this is where it came from. But if you take a step back and you look at the context of what happened on the heels of the OPM breach, which was a massive data breach that is hard to convey how important that event was in the history of the cybersecurity of the United States, the federal government decided that they were going to give a 2-year extension for the implementation of these requirements. Which, I mean, honestly, there's a lot of flaws that are in these rules, and there's a lot of contradictions, and there's a lot of assumptions, but that's quite the extension in the wake of this massive data breach. Okay, so then October 2016 rolls around, and they issue the final rule. Remember, we'll go back just for a second. Remember, like I said before, when we went from interim rule to final rule, it usually takes a while because they have to go through all of these comments in excruciating detail. So there's a big delay, but the rule doesn't really change all that much. There's the same boilerplate language, and we have the same provision and the same clause from beforehand. It's there because you need to be aware of the clause, but they also add in a little rider on the bottom, and they say, hey, your cloud service providers, your external cloud service providers that you're sending the data to, those are going to have FedRAMP moderate equivalency. That was a totally new addition. That wasn't included in any interim rule. That wasn't included whatsoever. Where that came from was DoD policy itself from the CIO, where the DoD CIO said, we have requirements that we're going to leverage on cloud providers. We have the authority to change our guidance, put it in the rule. So it isn't always necessarily the case that the interim rules will be exactly the text of the final rules. That's relevant because right now, we're in interim rule land with regards to CMMC, and there's a lot of DoD policies that are being written regarding supply chain, regarding a bunch of different operations, zero trust, and things like that. So don't be surprised when the final rule comes out if there's a couple of surprises in there. Okay, so some fun quotes from the final rule from 2016. Implementing these minimum security requirements may produce increased costs. But the protection of the information is necessary, right? That makes sense based off of the events at the time. And they say the implementation of these requirements will benefit you. We're actually doing you a favor because we're helping you protect your intellectual property. Now, over the years, they use the same logic in the rules multiple times. They say that, well, hey, this data that you have needs to be protected. Our data needs to be protected. Here's some data protections. Therefore, we all benefit. And they actually repeat that same thing over and over again in multiple different versions of multiple different rules. So they say the cost of compliance with this rule is unknown because everybody already has security in place. We can't tell you what the cost is going to be because you're telling us that things aren't implemented, but the standard hasn't really changed all that much. You wouldn't happen to be implying that our assumptions were wrong or that what you signed on to in your contract was somehow different from the requirements. So this is the same theme. Obviously, this is getting a little repetitive because they've been doing the same responses, the same behaviors, the same characterizations that we see today that are so frustrating back then and all the way back into 2011. So they say the security requirements in 800.171 are building upon the requirements that were in your contracts in 2013. Does this sound familiar? Because it's exactly what they say about CMMC. They say the new requirements in CMMC build on the requirements that were already in your contracts. And so even though there's no additional effort, or even while there is additional effort, none of the effort was lost because they're cumulative. Like, we're not asking you to totally change what you're doing. We're just asking you to work a little bit harder. Now, if you hadn't implemented what they required in 2013 and you haven't implemented what they were asking for in 2016, and now you're staring down the barrel of what's coming with the additional CMMC requirements, well, that's probably a lot of additional costs. We're going to get to that. Okay, so they say DoD does not develop cost recovery models because now that we've accumulated enough technical debt in 2016, people are like, this is really expensive. How am I going to recover from this? And they say, that's not our problem. That's not what we do. Costs are allowable. The requirements that are levied by the rule should be treated as any other requirement in your DFARS clauses, and those costs of compliance should be considered during your proposal. So don't sign up for these if you haven't done the math, is basically what they tell you. And then they say the cyber incident reporting, the media preservation, all of these requirements that are outside of 171, they're distinct requirements of the clause that are related to the information. So this is when they actually are getting down to the point where they say, listen, we have extra requirements over and above what we consider to be adequate security. This is the reason why when you go to the CUI registry, covered defense information is a special category of CUI because the totality of your obligations aren't contained only within 800.171. The DoD says, yeah, you got to do all those things because that's the minimum requirement for protecting CUI, but we also want you to have these reporting obligations. We also want you to have these data retention obligations. Those are not in 800.171. And we spoke about this in detail during my talk in July. Don't assume for the contractors out there that the totality of your requirements are in 800.171. You have to read the whole clause. Okay, so when they release it, they say, we had some alternative paths that we considered. We thought maybe we'll just exempt small entities. Or they said, maybe we'll delay the implementation further until we can actually calculate the real costs. Or maybe we'll create a completely different set of requirements just for small businesses. Those all seem like amazing things. Those all sound like things that people are asking for today, staring down the barrel of CMMC. This was back in 2016. So they said, hey, this is what we looked at. And then we rejected them. We rejected them as a conflict with the overall purpose of the rule. We're not making exceptions for anybody. And that, again, just like they said beforehand, regardless of the size of the contractor, you got to add these information system protections. All righty. So the final rule for FAR Basic comes out at this time. Remember, we're juggling three different things here. So we originally had the FAR Basic clause get split off, and now we have the final rule. It's pretty straightforward. This one is in all contracts. This one are basic requirements that people have for any covered information system, if you have information coming from the government, and that this focuses on basic levels of safeguarding that any prudent business person would implement. They just carry the same verbiage forward. What's funny is that the specific line in this final version of the rule, the very first line is, we're not asking you to do anything that you aren't already doing. they specifically say that prior to all of these FAR actions, the actual full federal acquisition regulation actions, the DoD has been updating their own DFARS rules, and they're all part of one larger set of steps in order to implement this across the federal government. Okay, so then in September 2016, the actual federal policy comes out for the agencies, which starts to kick off the timeline for those agencies to implement their own policies. This actually takes even longer because the agencies have to train their contract officers. The agencies have to put all this stuff in motion. This was 4 years ago. Now you're starting to see those policies actually get put in place, but everybody thinks that CMMC is going to go away because those policies don't have any teeth yet. In July of 2017, President Trump signs an executive order that says, we got to go figure out what's going on with the health of the industrial base. We're going to have to analyze all of the forces that are benefiting it, harming it. It's quite an interesting request in terms of an executive order report. The reason that it's important is because it asks for a report to be generated. We're going to talk about why that's important in a second. But right after, on this timeline, right after that executive order gets written, the Sea Dragon hack occurs. And this was a massive hack of submarine warfare technology by China. They just ripped all of the Sea Dragon technology out of the industrial base, which is really not great. This is a whole story in and of itself. I definitely recommend that you go read about it because it put into question the nature of the security that was deployed through the industrial base, even though we've done all this rulemaking and all this regulation and all these requirements beforehand. So as time goes along, remember, we're still dealing with the rule that was written in October of 2016. Several documents get written that just absolutely destroy the current status of cybersecurity in the industrial base for the federal government. And a lot of these are referenced specifically in the current interim rule, including the NDIA report. When the report that corresponds to Trump's executive order comes out, they list cybersecurity in the industrial base as one of the top 10 things that are posing a risk to the United States itself. In 2019, the Secretary of the Navy says the same thing. The Sarah Brin report comes out. These are all documents that we spoke about during the talk in the summer, but basically every one of them says the cybersecurity in the industrial base is terrible. People don't know what's going on in their contracts. Folks aren't doing what they're supposed to do. The government has no insight. We're getting breached just relentlessly back to back to back. And then in 2019, this DoD IG report comes out and basically says, we did an analysis of all these contractors, and no one's doing anything with regards to their DFARS cybersecurity requirements. Shortly thereafter, the FY20 NDAA gets written, and it specifically says it directs the government to create an auditing mechanism for cybersecurity in the industrial base. And then we get CMMC, so this two-pronged issue of the IG report with the NDAA is what results actually generate CMMC as we know it now. So cryptic diagrams, right? At this point, I will assume, here we go, assuming things, that everybody has heard this spiel before. CMMC is at level 3 is 130 requirements split across processes and practices. Practices are the requirements, the controls, the things that we were talking about previously. Processes are something new. That's kind of how they're going to measure the institutionalization of your security program in your business. They're going to actually make sure that you're walking the walk, not just that you have some technical controls in place. So the one takeaway that I want everybody to remember about CMMC is that most people read the model and they look at these requirement statements like AC.3.017, separate the duties of individuals to reduce the risk of malevolent activity. And they think, oh, there's 130 requirements, so I have 130 things to do. That is not true. If you go read a different document, the CMMC assessment guide, you actually have many, many things that correspond to that one requirement statement that you have to meet in order for that requirement to actually pass an assessment. You have to go through assessment objectives. You have to go through multiple assessment methods and objects. You have to produce all of this other work that in and of themselves represents sub-requirements. And if you go do the math, it isn't great because instead of having 130 requirements, you actually have 383 process objectives. You have 383 practice objectives, 323 process objectives. You have 700 in total things that you have to do that correspond to those 130 requirements. But 50 to 70% of them are non-technical. So what the heck does that mean? If you think back to 800-171, that should correspond to all the policy and procedure documentation that they assumed that you had the entire time. Okay. So then November 2020 rolls around, and that's when we get to the interim rule that we all know and love today. So they publish a rule in the Federal Register, and they say we have to be able to assess what's going on. Remember, every time a rule gets written, it's on the heels of something really bad that had happened. So we wrote the rule because we have to protect the information, very generic. And then OPM happens, and they say, whoa, 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 we got to worry about cloud, we got to worry about reporting. Then we go through the years, more breaches happen, IG reports happen, and they say, whoa, 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 we have to verify what's going on. So in context, CMMC is not something new. It's not a new set of requirements. It's just another facet of the same wave of requirements that have been slowly but surely coming our way since 2010. So they say we have to be able to assess everybody. We have to be able to provide assurances, same boilerplate language. And there's three main things that everyone's familiar with. There's the 7019 provision, the 7020 provision, and then actually 7021 itself, which is CMMC. Now, here's an important point for manufacturers. I tell people all the time, for manufacturers, the reason why it feels like it doesn't make sense is because CMMC was not written for you. In the rule, they list off the NAAQS codes that they use to do the cost analysis.
Sorry, go back.
That they use to do the cost analysis for CMMC. None of these are manufacturing NAAQS codes. I just want to reiterate this. When they did the cost analysis, they were not thinking about you. Right. You are part of the DoD supply chain. You are part of the supply chain of the overall federal government. So you are just the first group of people that are subject to CMMC. That doesn't mean that they took that into consideration whenever you are thinking about why these requirements don't make sense in your environment. Okay, so they give you the provision, they give you a clause, just like they did beforehand. They're going to say, hey, this is going to tell you the requirements are coming. This is going to be added to all solicitations. And then they say over here, if you're required to implement 800-171, then you have to have a current score in SPRS. This is all going to be very familiar based off of other webinars that you've been hearing over the last several weeks to months. It goes in all solicitations. And then you have to give government access if they're going to do an assessment. Okay. So there's a couple of quick takeaways from the interim rule. They say, again, the contractor should already be aware of security requirements they haven't implemented, and they have documented plans of actions and milestones. Of course you do, because these have been requirements for years and years, and you already have this security program. And therefore, when we calculate the burden to actually do these things, it should take you about 30 minutes to calculate your SPRS score and upload it. So then they have some stuff in there that says, well, why would we require senior employees to do this SPRS calculation? I'll let you read these when you get a copy of the slide, but the most important one is the last one. And they say the reason why we ask you to have a senior employee do this SPRS calculation is because the submission may very well determine whether or not the company is awarded a contract. That's very different from the rhetoric that we hear from CMMC folks about the nature of just have something in SPRS. Just make sure you upload your score. All right, when we actually get to the DFARS, or when we get to the CMMC rule itself, it says it's going to apply to all solicitations. This is very familiar. It's required for contract award. It's required that we have this prior to awarding the work. This is all the stuff that you've heard before. The part that you haven't heard is the part that's buried in the rule about the fact that all of these are assumed to occur on top of what you're already doing and the costs associated with CMMC. So for a level one certification, they assume that the cost of the assessment itself will be about $3,000 and that it's going to take very little support and that it's going to take, an assessor maybe half a week, and that all of the requirements in your level one certification have already been implemented because those are the basic rules that are already in the FAR clause that you've already been doing. So we're not calculating the cost of implementing the FAR basic CMMC level one. These are only the costs for over and above. Sound familiar from 2016 where they said we're only doing calculations over and above? For level two, they say the assessment's going to cost you $22,000. It costs $22,000 because of this combination of folks who are required, and that you're going to have non-recurring and recurring engineering costs. So you're going to have non-recurring one-time costs, and then you're going to have stuff you have to spend every year on top of that. Then they say at the bottom again, well, you are already doing 800-171. This is only pertinent to 65 of those things. Therefore, these engineering engineering costs only apply to the delta. They only apply to the things that you have to do, for the delta of requirements. It shouldn't be that big of a deal. Then they say, this is something I would really like people to pay attention to. They only estimate that this is going to be a stepping stone and that they don't anticipate releasing new contracts for folks to achieve level two. Now, I don't know about you, but in the many manufacturing clients that I've worked with, I can think of many other ways to spend $50,000 besides a stepping stone to get to level three. So effectively level two at this point with how the rule's written, don't even pay attention to it other than the fact that the requirements are cumulative in the model itself. So level three certification, an assessment's going to cost $50,000. That's what the rule says. Contractor support is going to be like $22,000. The assessment support is going to be like $30,000. So overall, your assessment cost is going to be about $50,000. They say your non-recurring engineering cost is going to be $26,000 and that the recurring cost every year is going to be $40,000. But you've already implemented 800-171, so therefore these estimated engineering costs are only associated with the delta of controls over and above what we're asking for you. So you can see the ratcheting of assumptions starting to hit people in the wallet, where if you didn't do it in 2013 and you didn't do it in 2016 when they estimated things over and above that, and you haven't done it recently, that they're continuing to stack on the assumptions, and if your technical debt doesn't keep up, then what's the estimate for implementing everything for the 110 and CMMC on top of that? Now, these are estimates, right? These are not quotes from the government. However, anybody that's familiar with how basic housing allowances work around military bases will know that rents and things like that usually coincide very strongly with whatever the government says the price floor is. I view these as price floors. We'll see if they change in the final rule. Okay. So where are we now? Of those three prongs, we still don't have the FAR rule written, but it's coming. More and more folks on webinars from the federal government are talking about it. We don't have the final rule for CMMC. We're only in interim rule land right now. And we have the 32 CFR federal side program in place, but the corresponding agency training programs and policies and things like that haven't been fully implemented yet. They're still waiting for those deadlines to go into place. So we get this executive order from President Biden about even more work going into the supply chain about security. And just like Sea Dragon and just like OPM, Sunburst happens. It's a massive solar winds hack that compromises basically the entire federal government, massive embarrassment, huge breach on the tail of an executive order, huge breach on the tail of an executive order. It's the same pattern over and over again. So you can look at the context of the rules and the content of the highlights that I've pulled out here and anticipate what's going to be in the final rule for CMMC. If you think that they're going to roll back the requirement, or if you think that somehow CMMC is just going to go away, I don't think you're correct. All righty. So let's sum up here with some common assumptions that manufacturers have in the field, and then we'll be done. All righty. So you don't have only 130 technical requirements. You have many, many more than that, and most of them are non-technical. The scope of your DFAR cybersecurity obligation is not just what's in 800-171. You have other obligations in the DFARS clause for reporting, data retention, and things like that. Remember, you're being pressured to put your SPRS score into the system because you're marking them as implemented. But because there are other requirements for your controls, that does not mean that they will pass in the eyes of an assessor. So be very careful about convincing yourself that implementation equals assessability. Don't assume that CMMC is going away. Also, if you may notice, we haven't talked about the CMMC accrediting body in any way whatsoever because they don't write the rules. They are a pawn on the chessboard of one part of this overall federal effort. So don't assume that they are in charge. Their hands are tied. They move at the direction of the program management office. So it's sort of a waste of time to really worry about what they're doing on a day-to-day basis. And don't assume there's going to be any monetary relief. Honestly, they'll probably just copy and paste the contents of the rule responses that they have in previous years in the upcoming final rule that we're waiting on about how they don't do cost recovery models. and about how this is just part of your overhead G&A. Like we talked about beforehand, they're already assuming you're managing your MSP. We talked about flowdown in a previous talk before, so don't assume that they have things under control. If they tell you, yeah, yeah, CMMC, it's compliance, we got it, be very suspicious of that answer. Also, don't assume that your customers are going to provide scalable, compliant infrastructure to you. People are talking about primes, just sort of giving folks these virtual desktop solutions or just giving folks the ability to be compliant. I don't know about you. There aren't a lot of manufacturing environments where you can just make stuff out of SharePoint. There's requirements that are unique to the manufacturing environment where you can't just extend that infrastructure down to these companies. If you want an example of that, a lot of folks have sub-tier processors or specialized processing houses that they have to send parts out to for coding or painting or annealing or whatever it happens to be. Those are your downstream customers. So are you going to extend your compliant infrastructure to those companies? Probably not. As you move up the scale all the way up to the prime contractors, it just doesn't scale down that way. And also, do not assume that you don't have to flow down. This is one of the main things that's not in 800.171. It's not in the body of the CMMC model itself, but this is the part that's really going to get folks. If you don't do your flow down, check out the July talk about flow down details for more information on that. Okay, last things as we wrap up. The cost of your CMMC compliance program is a function of the scope of your covered contractor information system. And the scope of your covered contractor information system is a function of how CUI and FCI flows through your business. So when you evaluate vendors, when you evaluate technologies, and especially when you evaluate consultants, especially those guys, don't trust them, on whether they're providing you any type of value in terms of your compliance transformation, do not just take gap assessment as the thing that you need to do. What you need is a scope assessment. So if anybody is selling you turnkey solutions, if anybody's telling you that you can get compliant with only technical or non-technical controls, if anybody's saying we're just going to assess your gaps and then we're going to go to remediation, you're going to waste your time, you're going to waste your money, and if you believe what they're selling you, there's a good chance you're not going to pass your assessment. So make sure that when you interrogate them that they understand that there are other requirements besides the 130. There's 700 of them. And if that is news to them, you might want to find a different solution provider. Okay. Last quote here. We opened with a very inspiring quote by Isaac Asimov. So here, security is an allowable cost. We went to great efforts to put these estimates in the Federal Register. You're going to roll these costs up. Everything's going to be exactly the same thing that they've been saying year after year after year. Katie said that like 2 weeks ago. You can see the same talking points because it's been the same rule the entire time. Katie's not saying anything different than the government has been saying since 2011. So if you would like more information about the details of some of these things and you would like to work on a compliance transformation that takes into context everything from a DFARS part down to a customer part, in how that relates to a manufacturing environment. We have extensive experience doing that. We find it very interesting. We've helped a lot of people be very successful in terms of saving time and money. But that overall is the course of the history of DFARS and what has contributed to technical debt for defense manufacturers.
Eric, first of all, thank you very much. Incredibly thorough, informative, and frightening. Mm-hmm. I think spot on. We're just about out of time here. Is it okay if folks reach out to you if they have further questions?
Yeah, absolutely. You can reach out to us either through our website or email me directly. I know a lot of folks in here are already familiar with how we operate. And these are some pretty in-depth topics, like we were saying. We had to go through a lot of information very quickly. When the slides come out, I would just like to reiterate, definitely go through and read those bullets pretty carefully. I don't like to read bullets to folks during a presentation, but they're taken – those are not my words. They're taken directly from the rule itself most of the time. So take a second, read, and think about how they've changed over the years, and then reach out and say, hey, am I understanding this correctly? Because I spent a lot of time reading the rules in terms of how these things have changed, and I feel like – every time I explain it to folks, every time I explain it to folks on an engagement, you know, it doesn't make you feel any better about the nature of the obligation or how much work there is to be done, but it does give people some solace to know that there is some rhyme and reason behind what's going on. CMMC is not something new. It's been this way the whole time.
Right. Understood. Okay. Great. Thank you very much. Again, I learned quite a bit. Again, some which was frightening. So thank you, Ivan, if we can move on here. So coming up, we've got a March 17th right around the corner, How to Reap the Benefits of a Company Operating System by Peter Hammond, an aerospace operations executive. It's going to be an online forum. And we're also looking at upcoming chapter topics around apprenticeship, how the value of it and the practical use of it, and then potentially current trends in A&D mergers and acquisitions. And on the last slide, again, there's over 250 chapter recordings, presentations available. If you're just joining us today, you're not a member, it's well worthwhile. There's so much valuable information that you really won't be able to find and access so quickly in other areas. So I want to thank you, everybody, so much. And thank you again to Jacob. It's excellent that we've got somebody that understands this so thoroughly, because for the rest of us, we don't have the time to get into the details and really understand how we got from where we were to where we are. And we look forward to seeing you on our next virtual meeting. Take care.